Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to this oral argument session of the Supreme Court of Texas. The Supreme Court has existed since 1836, but this is the first time we have ever sat in Edinburgh or in Hidalgo County. And it's a special privilege for me, if I may take a moment of personal privilege, to say that my father is an alumnus of this school back when it was Edinburgh Junior College. And he attended here in 1932 and 1933. And he took me to the campus once or twice when I was young. Boy, and I do not even begin to recognize it. Marvelous things are happening here at the University of Texas Pan American. We have two cases to hear this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are County of Cameron versus Charlene Mills Brown and others from Cameron County, and Texas State Bank versus Rutilio Vargas Amaro from Hidalgo County. We have allowed 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and the petitioner, who's seeking the relief in the court, will be able to reserve a portion of that 20 minutes for a rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We'll take a recess in between the presentation of each argument. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in County of Cameron versus Brown.
May it please the court. Mr. George Crahey and Ms. Susan Bonner will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Crahey will open with the first 10 minutes. Ms. Bonner will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this case presents a very simple question of whether or not darkness at night under the wide open sky is open and obvious, and whether or not a governmental entity can be liable in a premise defect cause of action for its failure to provide lighting at night under the wide open sky.
But counsel, this is not just darkness at night under the wide open sky, is it? I mean, we had a bridge. The decision had been made to light the bridge, and I believe there seems to be a misconnection between the briefing here, because the presumption seems to be on your part that there was no lighting, it was just a dark night. And the argument on the other side is that once the decision was made to light the bridge, there was a duty not to do so negligently. How do you address that argument?
Your Honor, I would address that argument by saying that the Court of Appeals and its decision makes no sense unless it is assumed that darkness at night under the wide open sky on this particular bridge is a dangerous condition, because that is the only fact under which respondents in this case can have a cause of action.
Well, how do you account for the fact that the Cameron County, I believe it was Kenneth Conway, wrote a letter that acknowledged that the condition of the bridge posed a serious threat and was dangerous?
Your Honor, I would say that Kenneth Conway is someone who is safer than the reasonable person, and that as a matter of law, darkness at night under the wide open sky cannot be a dangerous condition. It is not unreasonably dangerous to have darkness at night on a bridge, on a road, in a lot of circumstances. But in this particular case, under the facts alleged in the petition, darkness at night is not unusual. It is not unexpected.
Been no markings on the bridge, no reflectors, nothing to show a night driver where the bridge ended and the open air started.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the beginning.
Well, what if there had been no reflectors? Or inadequate or misleading reflectors on the bridge?
Your Honor, I don't think that in this case those facts would have changed the outcome.
That wasn't my question. You talk about darkness at night is not dangerous. Aren't there ways roadways could be dangerous?
Your Honor, I'm not saying entirely that darkness at night is not dangerous. What I'm saying is that it is not does not pose an unreasonable risk of danger that would create liability for a governmental entity. If there were no reflectors.
So a The highway department is just wasting its money in terms of liability if it puts reflector strips down in the middle of the road and markers showing where the roadway ends.
Your Honor, I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing to make a roadway as safe as possible. But under the facts of this case, and I think the only thing alleged was that the bridge was dark, it's not unusually unreasonably dangerous. It does not pose an unreasonable risk of harm to someone who is using the roadway in a reasonable manner. There are roadways, thousands and thousands of miles of roadways in Texas, and probably thousands of bridges and thousands of narrow roadways that have very little shoulder or that have barriers on the side.
Counsel,
that are dark.
Counsel, let me ask you, do you agree with the Court of Appeals in the way it sets out the elements that must have been pled in order for the plaintiff to show that sovereign immunity was waived in this case?
Your Honor,
Now, I'm not talking about its interpretation. I'm just talking about what legally the plaintiff was required to plead in order to show a waiver of sovereign immunity.
Your Honor, I believe the Court of Appeals may have made a slight error when it said that that we had to have knowledge of a premise defect or of a defect in the premise. I think what the law says under Payne is that we had to have prior knowledge of a dangerous condition. I think there's
okay,
a distinction.
Other than that, do you agree with the elements that were required to be pled?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor.
All right. And you're asking us to interpret the pleading as actually pleading that nighttime created an open and obvious danger. Is that right? Your position is that this case presents a question of whether darkness at night in Texas is an open and obvious danger.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So you're asking us to interpret the pleadings as alleging that, if I understand correctly.
Well, I think their pleadings, I think, are that they're alleging that darkness at night is not open and obvious, but I'm saying that as a matter of law, it is.
No, I understand that, but we have to properly review the pleadings and whatever other evidence may have presented relevant to the waiver of sovereign immunity issue in this case in order to determine whether or not this lawsuit goes forward. And so I'm looking at the pleadings and asking you if the way the case was pled, did they plead that nighttime was an open and obvious dangerous condition?
They didn't plead that, Your Honor.
All right. Didn't they in fact plead that once the decision was made to light the bridge, that then there was negligence in maintaining the lighting system on the bridge? And that, in fact, it was that failure that was the open and obvious condition. Isn't that kind of what the pleading says, in essence?
I think that's what they
do
plead.
Then for purposes of the waiver of sovereign immunity, why are we not to interpret the pleadings, if that's what they say, in that manner, as opposed to what you say? Aren't we legally obligated to do that with respect to considering the sovereign immunity issue?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because legally I don't think you can interpret these pleadings to be anything other than a premise defect cause of action.
Well, but if we look at the face of the pleadings, they don't claim that nighttime was an open and obvious danger. They claim that negligent failure to maintain the lighting system is what created the dangerous condition. Why aren't we obligated as a court to take that as the basis for their waiver of sovereign immunity claim when we review it?
I don't think that creates a waiver of sovereign immunity, Your
Honor. Why not? Assuming that that's the way we interpret the pleadings, as opposed to the way you want us to do it, why wouldn't that?
Well, Your Honor, as I understand the Texas Tort Claims Act, they can show waiver of sovereign immunity one of two ways, either by showing applicability of Section 101.021, that there was tangible personal property or motor vehicle involved, or under 101.022 by showing premises liability, either licensor liability or special defect liability. This is not a special defect, so it falls under licensor liability. It doesn't fall under 021 because this is a premise.
Well, I understand we're dealing with a premises defect, and that's the kind of claim that we have. The question I'm asking you is that when you read the briefing in this case, you put a spin on the pleadings that says that what you think they're claiming is that the open and obvious danger was the fact that it was nighttime. They say that the open and obviously dangerous condition was the fact that the bridge was lighted in some places and not in others, which was negligent maintenance of the lighting on the bridge. And I'm asking you that under the premises defect basis for waiving sovereign immunity, why are we not required to read the pleadings the way that they are stated as opposed to the way you would have us interpret them?
I think if you read the pleadings either way, Your Honor, they still lose, because if they are pleading that the danger was open and obvious, then they can't show liability for premise defect under a licensor theory, and therefore they can't show liability under the Texas Tort Claims Act, and they can't show liability under the Texas Tort Claims
Act. Why is that? Why couldn't something be open and obvious to the owner of the premises and not to the licensee?
I think it's a matter of...
Is that always the case, that if it's open and obvious, that means everybody should know and there's never a claim based on a premises defect?
Your Honor, I think the term open and obvious means that everybody knows, anybody can see who's reasonable, a reasonable, prudent person, can see that there is a dangerous condition. Therefore, they are charged with knowledge of it, and they are charged with the responsibility of taking precautions.
Does that mean that people shouldn't be driving on this bridge, that people should be able to say, I'm not going over the causeway, I'm staying here on the island, because when I look out on that bridge, I see some lights out, therefore I'm not going to do it? Are you saying that people should not have been using the bridge?
Your Honor, I'm saying that a person driving across the bridge, under the conditions alleged in this pleading, mm-hmm. would have known that it was a dark bridge.
Well, when they entered the bridge, when they first started, the bridge was illuminated. Isn't that right?
I don't know if that was...
Isn't that on the record, that the beginning portion of the drive onto the bridge, that the lights were illuminated then, and then at the middle portion of the bridge, lights were out because of what they alleged to be defective wiring?
Actually, Your Honor, the facts alleged in the pleadings are quite a bit different from the facts that the 13th Court of Appeals cites.
Well, I'm asking, what does the record reflect on that point?
The record reflects that half the bridge was lit, and I'm talking about both lanes of traffic, and... Well, let me backtrack on that. It's not entirely clear in the record, but the way it's pleaded in the petition is that one lane of traffic all the way across was lit. The other lane of traffic all the way across wasn't lit. The lane of traffic that they entered was not lit from start to finish. That's what's in the pleading.
The pleading says the first part of the bridge was illuminated for traffic heading towards South Padre Island. However, at the location of the accident, there was no illumination.
That's the way I understand it, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, Your Honor,
I just have one quick question for you. Is there any scenario you can imagine where you have a lighted structure where, under your theory, there would be a waiver?
Your Honor, I think there may be some cases where some artificial situations, and I was thinking of some hypotheticals. For example, let's say you had an outdoor arena. It's an outdoor situation. And you invite 10,000 people there for a nighttime football game, and people are leaving the arena, and all of a sudden the lights go out. And
you would say there'd be liability there.
That might be a situation.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say that it was the causeway, but the lighting was, the decision had been made to light the under part of the bridge for boat traffic coming through. And let's say that on the particular evening in question, half of those lights did not work, and a boat came through, and because of the way the entry through the causeway was lit, it caused the boat to run into the causeway. Would that be the scenario that would fit your definition?
That might be, Your Honor. But
well,
why
would this be
that,
any different?
Navigation lights are governed by federal law, and there's a whole bunch of standards set out in regulations as to how navigation lights would be lit.
But we're not talking about the policy decision on how they're going to be implemented. We're talking about, once that policy decision's been made, maintaining those lights. So let's say that you have the lighting system on the bridge for boat navigation as opposed to car navigation, and half of them were out, and it caused the boat to run into the bridge. And I believe you just said that would be a situation where immunity would be waived.
That would probably be, Your Honor. And I would say that because navigation lights are different from illumination lights.
Well, but now, aren't these lights on the causeway for drivers intended for the same purpose, to help people navigate over the bridge? I have a very difficult time drawing that distinction where there'd be waiver in the boat situation and not waiver in the car situation.
Your Honor, I would say that a stop light is used for a different purpose than a street lamp. A street lamp is there to provide illumination. A stoplight is there to actually tell someone to stop. Same thing with a navigation light. Tells people to stop and go. It's not there to provide lighting so that you can see more.
I can assume...
I've yielded the remainder of my time to Coco.
As long as we're asking questions, you can get on.
it seems to me that if I'm outside and it's dark and I get the benefit of light and I recognize without that light I won't have the benefit of light, that could be an open and obvious condition. I could anticipate that if the light went out, I'd have to be prepared to do whatever I'm doing in the dark. But is that the same thing as saying when I go into the light and I'm maintaining a speed or a direction of travel that's dictated by the understanding that I now have that this is a lighted avenue, and I come over a hill and all of a sudden the light disappears, isn't it also anticipated that there'll be a moment that my eyes won't work? There'll be a moment that I can't focus on what I'm doing. There'll be a moment when I'm incapable of doing the proper control and anticipating. Isn't that a problem in this case if the evidence is not that the open and obvious was that it's nighttime, but it's the anticipation that in one instance it's lighted and so I'm able to see, and in the next instance it's not lighted and I'm, because it was lighted, my vision's affected, I am now not able to see. Doesn't that pose kind of a problem with what this discussion is? How do you deal with it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for the simple reason that even if a decision is made to provide nighttime illumination on a roadway, the government cannot provide nighttime illumination everywhere. So there will always be a point where the nighttime illumination ends. And if we accept the premise that a roadway at night or a bridge at night that is dark is an unreasonably dangerous condition, then we must also impose on the government the duty to warn whenever the illumination ends. In other words, there'll be road signs going up all across the state of Texas, maybe 500 yards before artificial illumination ends on a roadway, as it always does, saying, warning, darkness ahead.
What if the lights are defective in that they pulsate, and they're not supposed to do that, and it causes the driver to be distracted because the light is flashing on and off?
Your Honor, I can imagine maybe if there are certain kinds of light that are excessively bright or strobing that could cause disorientation, but
So there could be a defective condition of lighting that would get you there.
I think lighting, I can't personally think of a street light ever having that effect on anyone. I can imagine other kinds of light maybe if someone had a big searchlight and they accidentally pointed it at a road and blinded half the motorists, that might be the kind of light that could give rise to a liability. But I don't think the absence of a street light is something that is a dangerous condition. It's not unreasonably dangerous for street lights to be out at night. And the dangerous condition that results and that's being alleged here is darkness. And darkness at night is the presumption. When the sun goes down, it's dark.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
5 minutes from this moment.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the State also requests that this Court reverse the decision of the Board of Appeals and affirm the trial court's dismissal for lack of jurisdiction. Your Honors, to address some of the questions that have already been asked, I want to go initially to Justice O'Neill's question, where she asked that given that the governmental entities had already made the decision to light the roadway, why isn't there a cause of action? However, the fact that a governmental entity has made a decision to light a roadway and may in fact have some responsibility to maintain the roadways does not mean that the plaintiffs don't have to establish all elements of a premises liability cause of action. That is our argument. Whether the state or the county has some responsibility to maintain this roadway is irrelevant with respect to whether the plaintiffs can establish that the lack of lighting created a dangerous condition and whether they can establish that they had no knowledge of this open and obvious danger. I think this was addressed...
Well, but that you're talking about the merits, aren't you? Rather than jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor. Under...
Well, you just went through the elements of how to prove a premises defect case.
Yes, Your Honor, I did. And to establish...
But don't they just have to plead a claim that will fall under part of the Tort Claims Act?
Well, they have to state a cause of action that would fall under the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Well, where did they not state a cause of action in this pleading?
Well, they can't state a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act, but because to do so, they would have to actually be able to state all the elements of a premises liability cause of action. And as a matter of law, they cannot do this, because when you look at the facts as alleged, they cannot establish that this lack of lighting created a dangerous condition. Or that they, and they also cannot establish as a matter of law.
Why not? That's what their pleadings say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and even the Cameron County Park System Director, again, wrote a letter saying this was a serious safety hazard.
Well, that apparently was his opinion, and you two have to look at the context of the letter.
Well, isn't that enough to at least get them past your pleading jurisdiction?
Mm-hmm. No, Your Honor, it's our position that that does not. Under TxDOT versus Jones, this court held that you actually have to state a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act.
Oh, no, but that's what we're trying to, understand is in what way they have failed to state the elements necessary to show the waiver of sovereign immunity. I mean, in what way did they fail to do that?
Because as a matter of law, the facts that they allege do not state a cause of action.
Why not?
Because these facts do not state a cause of action showing that there is, in fact, a dangerous condition,
Why don't the pleadings, coupled with the evidence that the trial court considered, including the letter that Justice O'Neill has referenced, get you there?
Because just saying something is so does not make it so.
But this is a plea to the jurisdiction, not a summary judgment motion. So we're not looking at determining whether or not there are factual issues to be resolved or not. We are weighing the pleadings in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. But when you weigh the pleadings and you look at the facts that they've actually alleged, they are complaining about the fact that there is no lighting on the bridge. That is what they are complaining about.
And again, that's the fundamental distinction I'm having problems with here. They're not claiming there's no lighting on the bridge, and y'all keep trying to put it into that box. What they're claiming is there is lighting on the bridge, and because there is lighting on the bridge and it's operating defectively, it creates a dangerous condition. And that seems to be a big distinction that nobody seems to be connecting on here.
Well, it's our position that the fact that the lights are not operating as they should be is, in fact, not a dangerous condition. That is how we get there. In the kitchen
well,
case...
Well, why isn't that a matter, as Justice Baker said, that would ultimately be resolved on the merits and whether or not they can actually prove their cause of action for premises defect?
There are a number of cases that have held that in order, under the Texas Tort Claims Act, and that is different than just any other private party alleging a cause of action against a private individual because of the state's sovereign immunity. Because of the state's sovereign immunity, you actually have to, the facts have to show that a cause of action actually exists.
Let me ask you this. I was intrigued by your co-counsel's talking about the arena situation. Everyone in the arena expects there to be lighting, and as they're exiting, all of a sudden the lights go out and someone falls downstairs, and he says that in that instance there might be liability. Why is this case not similar to that? That you're driving down the bridge, you expect lighting because there's lighting when you enter the bridge and it's going uphill, and then all of a sudden the lighting is gone. And as Justine was asking, you know, there is going to be some moment of disorientation because of the lighting that you expected to be there, all of a sudden going dark. Why isn't what your co-counsel said about the arena applicable here?
For several reasons, Your Honor. The hypothetical about the arena assumes that the lights are cut out and you have no light. When you're on a roadway, you have your headlights. You're required to have your headlights. You're not immediately plunged into darkness, as the Court of Appeals suggests. The second thing is that when there is a lack of lighting up in front of you, you can see it before you get to it. That in itself is open and obvious.
I always say that as a matter of law, just based on these pleadings.
Mm-hmm.
There was an allegation that they came over the top of the hill and the lighting ceased at the top of the hill. How can we say as a matter of law that the particular lighting at this spot did not create a dangerous defect?
because as a matter of law, the fact that this governmental entity has chosen not to light a roadway is not, in fact, a dangerous condition. If that is a dangerous condition, then every time there is an accident and there is one street lamp in it that is out, there will be a cause of action and a governmental entity will be able to be sued in spite of the fact that it's open and obvious as to exactly how much light is available, in spite of the fact that that does should not create a dangerous condition.
I want to go back to whether the elements of the cause of action were pled, and I thought I read your briefs to say that the plaintiffs failed to allege no prior knowledge. Are you giving up on that argument?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay, why couldn't that be cured by special exceptions?
Because they can't plead that. Under the facts of this case, they're complaining about the lack of lighting. That is something that is open and obvious to everyone. As a matter of law, they simply can't plead.
Okay, just procedurally, why couldn't you have filed special exceptions and allowed them to replead that?
Because this court has held that if in a situation with a plea of jurisdiction, if you can see from the pleadings that the plaintiffs would be unable to go back and actually allege a cause of action, they are not allowed the opportunity to do that. So looking at the pleadings, there is no scenario under the facts that the plaintiffs could state a cause of action, and therefore they should not be allowed.
Element? There's no scenario they could say no prior knowledge?
Under the facts of this particular situation where they're complaining about the lack of lighting. Yes, Your Honor.
You mean they had to notice it as they were approaching the bridge and they could have made a U-turn and waited till the ferry the next morning?
Well, I would suggest that it's probably, I don't think there's any driver who wouldn't enter this bridge simply because of the lack of lighting. This bridge was unlighted.
Well, then I don't understand how the prior knowledge is established as a matter of law.
It's established as a matter of law because darkness is open and obvious to everyone. There's cases that have held that. They haven't pled that they had no lack of knowledge simply because they cannot plead that.
So as long as I can see it's dark, I've just got to anticipate any problem the roadway may have.
If your cause of action, Your Honor, is based on the lack of lighting, certainly if there are other defects in the roadway, there may be liability based on some other defect. But if your claim is that the state or the county should be liable merely based on a lack of lighting, then you would not have a cause of action.
Let me make sure I understand. Your argument then that the condition was not known to the victim is based and tied upon your argument that it's open and obvious. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't quite hear.
Your argument on that element of the premises defect, that the victim had to have not known of it, is premised on the notion that it was open and obvious.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if that notion falls, if this court finds that it was not open and obvious, we don't need to address that point.
That may be correct if this court were to find that darkness were in fact not open and obvious, but if it seems to me if this court were to find that, then the state would possibly have some duty to light every roadway.
Well, no, I just wanted to make sure that you're tying those two elements together. And so that element rises or falls on your argument of open and obvious. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's open and obvious and because licensees are imputed with knowledge.
I understand that. So the answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
That the government is attempting to use is the wide open spaces of the world are dark, and we all know that. That is absolutely true. Now, what are we to do about a bridge that has lighting on the entrance, and then once you are on this bridge, this two-lane bridge with no way to get out, going in one direction, the lights are out?
How do we know that that's the case? Is there affidavit testimony that as you enter the bridge, the lights are on?
Well, that is the pleadings in the case, and I think they have to concede that that is the fact scenario that we're operating under in review.
Entered the bridge.
Yes, on review of a dismissal for want of jurisdiction.
I understand.
Obviously, the standard is such.
I'm wondering how far this is going to take us, though. Let's assume a hypothetical of icy bridges in North Texas. If the government has assumed responsibility now for putting down salt on these bridges, and they decide to do so for a few bridges, but not all bridges in the area, are we going to have liability in those situations?
Justice Rodriguez, I think that's a very good question. I have to go to the statute. Abrogation of sovereign immunity is a creature of statute. I go to Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 101.022. A, you have a premises defect. What is the duty that the state or the county owes? It is the same duty a private landowner owes to a licensee. What is that duty? I go to the pattern jury charge, section 664 and 667, and do the facts of what you have just outlined fit into the four or three, depending on which claim is made, elements of that premises case? Is there an unreasonable risk of harm that the governmental entity has knowledge of? And again, your hypothetical assumes that the government has already taken the affirmative step of acting on this. The government has already assumed that duty. And that is the issue that Justice O'Neill was bringing up, that while the government might not have an obligation to put salt on that bridge, the government has recognized an unreasonably dangerous situation. They have undertaken a duty to act. Well, now they are in the situation of a private landowner. And we look at the four prongs of pattern jury charge section 664, and we say, did they have knowledge of the danger? Was the abrogation of this duty to make this safe something that caused an unreasonable risk of harm? Did they have actual knowledge of it? Did the motorist have knowledge of that? And did they fail to use ordinary care to
put it? But doesn't this now put the state and governmental entities in the undesirable position of not salting down bridges and not putting lights out?
One would certainly hope not, Your Honor. I mean, I think that certainly the first order of public policy is public safety. And we have to assume that, and I would say that it would be a mistake to make public policy based on the assumption that, well, if we give them the responsibility of doing this non-negligently, perhaps they will not do it at all. I think that we have to assume that.
Well, but governments, just like private litigants, alter their conduct depending on the exposure to liability. Isn't that correct?
I think that's a fair statement.
I mean, and one of the public's policy judgments is protecting the public fisc. So I think you're going to need to address that argument, that if we go along with you, are we saying, or are we giving the impetus of government to begin drawing back from what everyone would consider to be a safe operation, lighting or standing bridges?
Justice Jefferson, I think that the government stands in the shoes of a private litigant under these circumstances. They have no more or less protections. Now, the protection they have, obviously, is a limitation of damages that can be recovered, and they can't be sued for not initially taking that step. But once they do, the statute plainly says that's the duty that they owe.
Where do we draw the line? Let's suppose I'm driving down a highway in Houston, Texas. It's relatively flat, five lanes wide. Half the lights are out, but there's some visibility. How do you decide on the pleadings that there's a dangerous defect or not? I mean, are we saying that every time street lights are out in the city, that the county, the city, the state, TxDOT's liable?
I think that, and that's...
Or has waived immunity?
And just so on that, you're assuming that the government did undertake to light this and that the lights were non-functioning?
Every highway, every interstate highway that goes through the city.
Well, the government doesn't have a duty to light any highways. But once they have assumed the duty...
How many lights go out before? I mean, is it one light if they waive sovereign immunity? If one light goes out, five lights, 10 lights?
I think it's a
Where do we draw the line?
I think it's a very good question. It's ripe with fact issues. I think that the burden would be on a litigant in that situation, a plaintiff, to show that there was, A, an unreasonable risk of harm, and that may be very difficult with one light out, to show that there was an unreasonable risk of harm that caused...
But wouldn't that take every case now to the merits as opposed to jurisdiction?
I think that when you're reviewing something on the pleadings, unfortunately, you may be looking at what are the merits of this case? What are the fact issues in this case? As Justice Baker said, now we're down to the merits of the case. That may be. I don't think that it's going to cause a flood of litigation because I think it's a very, very difficult case to make that one light being out on a highway it suddenly causes an unreasonable risk of harm to the motorist. If a person were to bring that suit, and the suit were to be dismissed for want of jurisdiction on the standard that we're looking at right here, I don't know if you could have a situation where the court could say, as a matter of law, one light out simply does not an unreasonable risk of harm make. And there you are. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, you'd need to try that case.
I'm sorry?
You would need to try that case.
I believe that, and I believe it would be a heavy burden indeed on the plaintiff, Justice Heck, to try a case like that. But I don't think that the government should stand in any different shoes than a private litigant as against a licensee if that's what the statute says that they stand. I think that the outdoor arena analogy is a part of
that. Both the county and the state insist that your pleadings can't be read to show an allegation of lack of prior knowledge. And the Court of Appeals said that agrees with that, but lack of knowledge is implicit from a total reading of the pleadings. What's your answer to their argument?
I like the Court of Appeals analysis of that, Your Honor. I will.
Well,
I think
if we read the same pleadings, could we come up with a different view that it's not implicit, so you fail to meet that prong of the premises defect?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I was being a little facetious. I think that under the standard that we're talking about here, with a dismissal for want of jurisdiction without a deposition being taken in the case, under the standard of Ramirez versus Leifert, in other words, they're not just saying we didn't plead it. They're saying we couldn't plead it. Given the opportunity to replead under these circumstances, we could never plead
that. Well, I understand that argument, but the first part of it is that it's not pled now, and how can it be read into what's there to satisfy the elements that would keep you in court?
I think it can be read in certainly through the fact, as the justice has pointed out, that on the entrance to the bridge, there are lights. You are then plunged into darkness. There is a rise in the bridge. There are the correspondences going back and forth that were before the trial court between the county and the state about this serious safety hazard. Clearly, number one, the fact that they...
Well, but that all that doesn't go to the element of lack of prior knowledge of your client.
If the question
of course, and the argument, of course, is, well, when you come up over the rise of the causeway, it becomes obvious there's no light. But is that the real test of what prior knowledge is?
I think it has to be under the facts of this case, Your Honor, yes. And I'll tell you why I say that. The government's position is prior knowledge refers to knowledge of darkness in the wide open spaces of the world. We all have prior knowledge of that, that sometime this evening it's going to get dark outside. The question is not whether the government has the obligation to light the great outdoors, and we all know that is not the question
that's
being presented.
Well, let's say we agree with you that the nature of the premises defect is not the fact that it's dark, but the nature of the premises defect that you're alleging is the lack of lighting partway on the causeway.
On the bridge, Your Honor.
Which is what you allege.
That is exactly right.
And then the next thing is, where can we find that you allege that he didn't know that there were no lights?
Well, I think that if you're looking to the pleadings to see where that is implicit...
Well, that's where we have to start, don't we?
Well, I think that's true, Your Honor. And I think that, as I said, under the Ramirez versus Leifert standard, the question is, could we amend to make that allegation? In the pleadings, it is very clear that the entrance to the bridge is lighted. And then, according to the analogy, the stadium is plunged into darkness. I think it is certainly a fair reading of the pleadings that when one enters a bridge that has lighting on it, one naturally assumes that there is going to be lighting on the bridge and conducts themselves accordingly.
But you're on the other side of my question. My question is not that you assume there's going to be lighting, but did you know or not know before you went on the bridge that there was no light?
Which is
the element you have to show on the merits to win, but you at least have to plead it to stay in court on the jurisdictional.
I think my point is, Your Honor, that the element is the element of surprise. If there are lights at the beginning of the bridge, it is natural.
I respectfully disagree with that. Did you plead no prior knowledge or not?
I don't believe it says in the pleadings no prior knowledge. I think it says the pleadings has a description of the bridge, that there's lights to the entrance. This raises a very interesting question.
Well, I think so, because if you didn't plead it, they're right.
Well, Your Honor, I think if it's implicit in the pleadings, then, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, then their argument fails. And in addition, if we could, by amendment...
Well, speaking of what the Court of Appeals said, there seems to be a lot of statements by the Court's opinion about facts. Is it a fair statement to say that all of the facts that are in that opinion were pleaded by you?
No, I do not think that is correct, Your Honor. I think that some of the facts were derived from testimony and evidence that was presented at the hearing. It was not all contained in the pleadings, no.
What if there is evidence that he had been over the bridge 50 times before in its same condition without the lighting or the partial lighting? Did you try to negate that in your pleadings?
There's two answers to that, Your Honor. One is, I think that obviously we've got some fact issues in this case. The case was dismissed without ever taking
the depot. But did you plead that? Did you try to negate that, that he'd never been on, he'd not been on the bridge in this condition before?
We did not plead that, Your Honor. And it may be that the person whose knowledge we should be looking at in terms of knowledge of the darkness is actually Hector Mucio Martinez, who was the gentleman who was driving over the bridge that struck the disabled vehicle. Perhaps that's the person whose knowledge we're looking at. This is a case that was dismissed before a deposition was ever taken, and certainly Hector Mucio Martinez's deposition was never taken. His knowledge, the second motorist's knowledge, may be the knowledge that we really need to be looking at here in terms of whether he had knowledge of the hazard. But I think it's certainly a fair reading from the pleadings that You've got an entrance way that's lighted, and then as Enoch pointed out, you have a intermittent lighting after that. And I think the analogy of the stadium is a very, very good one.
Part I'm having difficulty with is if you're in a car that's wrecked and the road's not light, and you can see that, but it's not a lighted roadway, wherever it is. Can't you then, at that moment, anticipate that you're in a very dangerous condition and you better not be out there because somebody may come zooming along and hit you?
I think that is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Now,
how can you get over the hurdle of showing that the plaintiff didn't have knowledge?
Well, when a person is in the midst of the hazard, they have knowledge. When they have fallen down the unlighted stairs, they have knowledge when they're on the way down. But the question is, the peril was created by the hazardous condition of the lighting on this bridge. The fact that when one person was in the midst of the disaster, they were aware of it, doesn't absolve the state.
Let me ask you, I was not clear about that. Do you claim that the peril caused the first accident or the second?
No, the second, Your Honor, absolutely.
Yeah. So when you're getting out of the car, though, but you can see that this is dangerous.
It may, Your Honor. I think that, as I said before, it may be that the individual whose knowledge we will be looking at in this case, should this case go back to the trial court, is Hector Mucio Martinez, because that's the person who drove onto the road, onto the bridge, with every expectation that it would be lit, and all of a sudden he's plunged into darkness, and there is a hazard that he hits. Certainly, it's our allegation because the highway was unlit, and I think that is, in fact, the avoidance of collisions, the kind of a hazard that the county was talking about in these correspondence when they talk about an extreme safety hazard, an extreme risk, and all.
So you don't think the plaintiff has to prove that he himself didn't know, somebody else who was participating in the event?
That's an interesting question. Perhaps the analogy is this, and I'm not sure of this, but perhaps the analogy is this. In a slip and fall case in a grocery store, I see the slippery part on the floor, and I'm aware that it exists. Another individual comes and slips in it and drops produce on me. Well, I'm the plaintiff, I'm the injured person. My knowledge might not be the applicable one. It might be the knowledge of the person who actually slipped in it, thereby causing me.
Well, if he had knowledge, if the second driver had knowledge, does the state, are they out?
I think it also depends on whether or not we can show gross negligence, because if you can show gross negligence, then that prong is taken out altogether. When you're looking at here I refer to pattern jury charge, section 66.7, which also has to do with a private landowner's obligation to a licensee. And the three prongs are these: condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm, defendant failed to adequately warn of the danger or make the condition reasonably safe, and the defendant's conduct was more than momentary thoughtlessness, inadvertence, or error of judgment. In other words, they either knew or were substantially certain that the result or a similar result would occur. If we can show that the state was grossly negligent, and here we get back to some of these correspondences going back between the state and the county, we don't have to show lack of knowledge. And that's just the law of the state of Texas as it pertains to licensees against a private landowner, which is basically what we're dealing with.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, in some respects, Mr. Bright just stole some of my thunder, because that's what I was actually prepared to address to this court, and that is a situation in which, if we assume that Nolan Brown had knowledge of the unlit condition prior to his entering the bridge on September 16, 1996, would our case be defeated? And it's my position, Your Honor, that it is that we can show that gross negligence in this particular case. We can show that on the occasion in question, for almost a year, the lights were out on this particular bridge, the longest bridge in the state of Texas, and that there were lights that were out, that the state, Mr. Conway, is writing letters saying that this presents a serious public safety hazard. They recognized that it was a dangerous condition. We can show that there was gross negligence, and even though we may not have pled it in this particular pleading, we could have pled it, and we certainly will plead it. And under, as Mr. Bright has just said, under Article, excuse me, under...
Did that come up to the trial court? Was this argued before the trial court?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
Well, what are we to do with that?
Well, Your Honor, that's, we go to the standards of a plea to the jurisdiction.
No, I understand, but if your argument now, for the first time, is now we say we have a gross negligence claim and complete it, how can the trial court err by not allowing special exceptions to allow you to plead gross negligence if you didn't ask the trial court to allow you to do that?
The plea of the jurisdiction, it is, the trial court has to take into consideration what could have been pled, and even though it wasn't
But can't the trial court presume by the fact that you didn't plead it and didn't ask to plead it, didn't ask to amend, that you didn't, I mean, are we to presume that in every case someone can plead gross negligence and bring it up for the first time on appeal?
If it defeats a plea to the jurisdiction, yes, because under the standards of a plea to the jurisdiction, it's not only what was pled, but what could have been.
Well, I understand, but maybe we should term it in terms of preservation of error. I mean, there's something that doesn't seem right if you haven't brought it to the trial court's attention and allowed the trial court to address it then. It just doesn't seem that you would preserve that point on appeal and bring it to us for the first time.
Well, Your Honor, I haven't addressed this from a waiver situation, but I think that because of the case law, and the case law under Ramirez versus Lifer Consolidated School System, it allows us under common law to do that, that we have under a plea to the jurisdiction that right to either plead it or what could have been pled. And since we could have pled gross negligence, and it does defeat their particular argument as to the plaintiff's knowledge saying that we don't have a case, then I think in that case, under a plea to the jurisdiction standpoint, we have the ability to later on amend our
petition. I don't remember seeing this in the briefs. Is this in the briefs? I've not seen
yes,
this.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
No, I understand that you've argued in the briefs that you could have pled actual knowledge on the victim's part. And I've heard the argument in the briefs that as a matter of law, if you can specially accept and it can be cured, you should be allowed to do that. I don't recall reading in the briefs you now saying that you have a gross negligence claim that you could plead. As I recall the briefs, it was everyone sort of agreed that there was no gross negligence pled, and I didn't see that as a point under the special exceptions discussion.
What you're correct, Your Honor. What we said is, as we were just quoting the Ramirez cases, is because under the plea of the jurisdiction standard, what could have been pled, then we would therefore defeat their plea to the jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
And please the court. Your Honor, I believe the plaintiffs are making an assumption in this case that should not be made and asking this court to make an assumption. Basically, they say that once the state or the county assumes a duty by putting up a lighting system, then the assumption is that without a lighting system, the road is unreasonably dangerous. And that is just like the example that Justice Rodriguez posed was, if you don't make a decision that you're going to put salt out on some bridges, does that mean that you have to salt all bridges or you're liable? And I believe that the plaintiff's position is that yes, absolutely. They are asking this court to bypass the elements of a premises liability cause of action and assume that once we have made the decision to put in a lighting system that the road is unreasonably dangerous if for some reason that lighting system
doesn't. I think they say something else. I think they say once you put in a lighting system and you fail to maintain it, you may create a dangerous condition. What's your answer to that?
Well, I think they're asking you to do more than that because they seem to never have they explained how simply the failure to have lights on created a dangerous condition. they don't actually really analyze that in their brief at all. They don't cite any cases that show just merely the lack of lighting creates a creates an unreasonable risk such that it's a dangerous condition. Really, it seems
to me... Apparently some of the state employees felt that.
Excuse me?
Governmental employees thought that.
There was one governmental employee that talked about there being a safety hazard, but that is not the same thing as a court deciding whether that hazard creates an actual dangerous condition under a premises liability cause of action. The fact of the matter is that the state makes all kinds of modifications to roadways every single day that make roads safer, and we want the state to do
well,
that.
Well, all they had to do was put up the lights and they would have made the road safer here, wouldn't they?
If the lights had been on, Your Honor, there would have been some element of greater safety. But the question is, without those lights, is the road a dangerous condition? And it's our position that no. Simply having roads without lights does not create a dangerous condition. There are roads all over this state. All you have to do is drive down the roadway.
You're moving past that. Past what the issue is here. To reach the decision that the state and county one in this case, the court would have to decide that as a matter of law, if darkness is the causative factor in the accident, then no negligence on the part of the state would ever be the basis for the waiver of sovereign immunity. Just darkness as a matter of law. A difficulty I have in coming to that conclusion is because it seems to me I could think of a scenario where the state is in charge of providing lighting for safety purposes. The lighting is negligently maintained and therefore goes out, and as a result, to someone's surprise, they are unable to see and they are therefore injured. The state could go back to the decision in this case and say, wait a minute, if it's the darkness that caused the injury, the mere fact that the state had a light that went out does not waive sovereign immunity. It would seem to me to hold as a matter of law here that darkness causes the injury, the fact that a light went out could never be the basis for liability of the state is a very, very broad holding.
Well, Your Honor, certainly under the facts in this case, the fact that lights were out did not create a dangerous condition.
Well, I just don't understand that argument. I mean, if you're standing there on a dark roadway and somebody can come along and hit you, it looks to me like you're in a dangerous condition. How can everybody know that but the state?
Well, it's not a dangerous condition because it doesn't create an unreasonable risk of injury. You have to look at the
action. Of course it does. You're standing there in the dark and somebody's going to hit you. Now, maybe the state's not liable for that. I don't know, but surely you know, I mean, you're making the argument that the plaintiff should have known as a matter of law that he was in a dangerous condition. How can the state not know?
The state certainly may know that the lights were out. But the question is whether, in fact, that condition was a dangerous condition.
Well, how do we know that the driver, that the second driver, might have been driving 15, 20 miles per hour slower if the first part of the bridge had not been illuminated? And when he came over the rise into the non-illuminated part of the bridge, he was going too fast to stop. Now, aren't we supposed to construe these pleadings fairly liberally in determining if there's jurisdiction?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't think there's any facts in this particular record at all that a rise in the bridge played a part in this particular accident. Second of all, I think that the second driver is not the plaintiff. It's not the licensee that we've been, that we're looking at what duty we
have. Is it what the second driver knew? Isn't that what's critical here?
Excuse me?
Is it what the second driver knew? Isn't that one of the elements that's critical here?
Well, with respect to the plaintiffs proving up their cause of action, I think we have to look at the knowledge of the actual plaintiffs in this case. But I would suggest that the second driver, too, had to know of the situation of there being darkness on the bridge. And with respect to the second driver, the plaintiffs in this case haven't sued us based on the real condition in this case. The real condition.
Are you still answering Justice Owen's question?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
Because they cannot sue based on the fact that there was an obstruction in the roadway, the disabled vehicle that they created themselves. They have sought instead to hold the state liable for a condition that they cannot show as a matter of law is dangerous, and they cannot show that they lack knowledge of that condition.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the first cause, we will take a brief recess.
All right. Please remain in place until the court has departed. Thank you.